Hello and welcome to another episode of Stump Mike, the cricket podcast where nothing much has changed dramatically since last week. I am Srinath Sripath and joining me to discuss a crazy week in Pakistan cricket is Daniel Rasool, a man in Pakistan who's travelled with the caravan as cricket returned to the country. Hey Daniel, welcome on Stump Mike for the first time.
Hello, good to join you guys.
Pleasure to have you and pleasure also to welcome another friend of the pod, Ahmed Naqvi, more popularly Karachi Katmal on Twitter. Welcome back after a few months, Ahmed. How are you doing?
I'm great, guys. Thank you for having me.
Super. I guess there's pretty much only one place to start. Daniel, what just happened over the last week? The number one T20 side in the world, whitewashed by a second string Lankan team, which is not unfair to them when I say that. What's been happening? How do you explain what's been happening?
There's a bit of an irony in this because a lot of the times what people said over the past 2 weeks was Pakistan, ticket sales weren't doing too well because Sri Lanka didn't have a good team over. And that explained, apparently, that was one of the reasons why there were so many empty seats in Karachi. But here, they fielded a second string side. By the third game, they were fielding effectively a third string side because they rested five players from the second string team. And by the end, I just came away thinking that there was no mathematical permutation capable of throwing up 11 Sri Lankan men who will not beat Pakistan in a T20 right now. There's no explanation really for it because Sri Lanka's posted a high total, a mid-sized total, a low total, but they were just capable of defending it. Pakistan obviously had they had bad starts in each of those three games. But there's a lot more than that. Let's just start off here.
Amir, equally surprising is been watching Misbah in press conferences. We are not used to seeing Misbah like this. Misbah has got a lot of admirers from across the border as well. He's one of those cricketers whose calm is respected pretty much around the world. It's been really, really weird and kind of sad watching him in press conferences, shooting answers. Even at Daniel, I think we'll get to that. It's really been weird.
No doubt. I think this was the last thing that anyone expected from Misbah. I think, like, for me, Pakistan losing to a second string or third string Sri Lankan side in some random bilateral is not that big a surprise. I think the Pakistani cricket culture, far beyond this one team, generally has had a problem with being consistent and sort of showing up for these sort of random kinds of matches. And again, like at the start of a new era, so, you know, on that sort of stuff didn't surprise me. What has really surprised me has been Misbah's prickliness in the press. I mean, his calm in front of the media was really one of his most famous attributes. And knowing the Pakistani cricket media, to think that Daniel was provoking or managing to provoke Misbah with a pretty simple question is I think, you know, if you can't handle Daniel, I'm sorry, there's a lot less reasonable, a lot less rational people in that same fraternity. So it's kind of shocking.
Go on, Daniel, I'll let you have your defense.
Yeah. So I'm fairly inexperienced. I've been in this field about 3 years and I'd never interacted with Misbah before he became head coach. And so everyone said, oh, Misbah's so calm, Misbah's collected, Misbah can handle the press really well. He's intelligent. He'll deal with your questions. He'll engage with them. And so I asked a fairly simple question and then there was Misbah coming back at me with not really engaging with the question. I guess a lot of players can feel the pressure, but for Misbah to feel it so soon is a slightly worrying sign. Remember just 2 weeks ago, remember that clip that went viral where some journalist quite provocatively asked him about his own attributes as a tuk-tuk player and he mentioned the words tuk-tuk quite a lot and we expected Misbah maybe to react to that and Misbah in the end said, tuk-tuk pe zyada zor and everyone started laughing and that was classic Misbah. He would diffuse situations, he would lighten rooms with his humor, with his gentle intelligence essentially. And it seems like months ago now, it was just 2 weeks ago. So yeah, the development has been surprising for me too.
I think there's one more thing that, you know, what is significantly different for the first time in Misbah's entire cricketing career and his professional life even, is that he is no longer the underdog fighting the odds, you know, and he doesn't have anyone else who is responsible for what's happening. So even as captain at his strongest, you still had the coach and the chief selectors and, you know, there was always some sort of friction happening over there. So I think, I mean, again, I'm very surprised that it's happened so quickly, but the fact that Misbah is now in a situation where he does not have really, there's all the kind of the blame or whatever you want to call it is coming on him. That seems to have caused this provocation. But again, that might be a reason for it, but it would be a very surprising reason.
I think it's also, this is one of the first times in his career where his strategy has been shown up almost as daft instantly, because he took a risk that many people thought it wasn't necessary to take with his team selection. And then not only the fact that it was a risk, the fact that he came to be coach in somewhat controversial manner with the way Mickey Arthur went and the fact that Misbah was on the committee that recommended that, and then he came up. And then when he called up Omar Akmal and Shahzad straight away, it seemed like an instant two-fingered salute, if you will, to Mickey Arthur's philosophy and the way he'd actually advocated removing Omar Akmal as one of the ways to rebuild his T20 side. So I think that was interesting, the fact that he didn't need to take a risk in what was a fairly low-profile series, as Emmer said. It has been quite startling, but I think that's something that's been playing on his mind as well and adding to the pressure on him.
Did he not say in the presser at the end that it's a shock to the cricketing system because we kind of thought that Sri Lanka is sending a weaker side, let's experiment a bit, etc.? Did he not say that, Danya?
Yeah, but I think that's also a bit of a straw man, because he said a couple of times, he said more than twice actually, that people said, oh, we should rest our team, we should play a second string team. Other than Ramiz Raja, who said it a couple of times, I'm not sure how many people were actually saying, oh, we should rest our players. Because the narrative in Pakistan was, we want to see high quality cricket, international cricket in Pakistan. So I'm not sure there was an appetite for Pakistanis to turn up and see a rested team. So I'm not sure that point quite holds up. Maybe Emma has a different view.
No, not really. I think I think, you know, Daniel has mentioned it, but I really can't explain in simple terms just how distressing it was to see Omar Akmal and Ahmed Shahzad in the national side again. And for Misbah, of all people, to bring him back. Bring the both of them back. I mean, you know, like his captaincy has had to suffer a lot because of those two. So he would have known it better than anyone else. And so I think what Daniel just said, that the only way that you can kind of make sense of it is that he's gone out of his way to show up Mickey Arthur's kind of approach. And again, that is not the kind of image that one had of Misbah, that somebody who's who'd be petty like that. Or perhaps, you know, you could, if this had happened like a year or 2 years down the line, and you could say the pressures of the dual role are getting to him, etc. Literally at the first turn, without a lot of media pressure either coming into this, and really a clean, blank check. He could have really gone ahead with the other lesser heralded players in the country rather than bringing back some notorious names who, just from an optics perspective, were always going to make life difficult for him.
Yeah, I think you did a thread on Twitter explaining why it's such a Pakistani thing to do, etc. But again, Misbah kind of defies and bucks that sort of stereotype usually. Daniel, not a very happy memory, but one that came to my mind is Louis van Gaal during his time at Man United, playing a bunch of kids against MK Dons very early into his tenure. He's playing a third division side and they lost 4-0 to them. And then basically everyone was saying that he's played all of them to show the world that they're not good enough. Is that theory, that does it hold any water at all? And secondly, for those of us who are not following the domestic setup closely, what kind of merited Ahmed Shahzad or Umar Akmal to come back? Is it just their past reputation, or do they have the numbers to back it up of late?
The first point that you made, the comparison with Louis van Gaal and the MK Dons game, I don't think it holds up very well, because if this was an ODI against a decent enough side or a test match, or a test series, you might be able to say, yeah, this holds up. Pakistan have been on the decline. But in T20 cricket, Pakistan did lose 3 of their last 4 under Mickey Arthur. But other than that, Pakistan were phenomenally consistent in T20 cricket for the past 3 years. So this is a strange format for Misbah to make this point and say, we haven't been doing well and we have to face reality. Because in T20 cricket, the idea was we are building up to next year's World Cup, where this 4-year cycle has been outstanding for Pakistan. And the only problem is we didn't have a World Cup in 2018 because Pakistan fancied they might win it. So I don't think this is the format to make that point. So I don't quite agree with that. In terms of your second point about what merited their call-up, Omar Akmal did have an okay PSL. He averaged, I think, 32. He had a strike rate of 134, but nothing phenomenally great to suggest he should be recalled, given the way that he was dropped and the number of times he's been given chances. And then in the Brampton League in Canada, which isn't the highest league anyway, he had a poor four games, the four games that he played. Shahzad had a much better PSL, so maybe you can understand his call-up, even though PSL pitches are obviously significantly different. But, you know, I mean, how many times do you give players who perform domestically chances again only to see them not perform internationally? I keep saying if Mark Ramprakash, for example, was Pakistani, he'd have been dropped and then re-picked about a dozen times. At some point, you have to take a call.
Yeah, there's one funny thing that I saw. I don't know how much Yunus Khan meant it. He was on Shoaib Akhtar's YouTube channel, Amir, where Dr. Noman Niaz, I think, asked him, India's got this guy, that guy, this is their bench strength, where's our bench strength? And Yunus proceeds to lift up an empty chair and shows that this is our bench strength. Is that an exaggeration at all? Did they not have anyone else to do for the home series?
I mean, okay, so first up, I have not been following the domestic game as keenly as some of the other people involved here, and so there could well be a reason the players that I'm missing out. But I mean, just off the top of my head, you've got that young guy called Abid Ali, who, or is that his name? Like, I think he's made to the national side a bunch of times. You've got that option. You've got obviously someone like Rizwan, who was, I think, dropped from the squad altogether for the T20s. I opened up the 2019 batting charts in the PSL. And these are names I'm just plucking out. I'm not sure how great they are. But like someone like Sohail Akhtar for the Lahore Qalandars had 241 runs, with average of 30. Or, there's a bunch of other names in here as well. So I think my larger point is that with each of these names, you still, even if they failed, if they gave you Umar Akmal's output, which was two consecutive golden ducks, it wouldn't be that big a deal because you're trying someone else out. Bringing these two particular players back was really shocking. And in that sense, I think, like, for me, like, the thing that freaked me out the most was that under Misbah, like, I wasn't expecting us to have immediate success, or maybe not even any success whatsoever. But what I was hoping for was a different way of doing things, which is what his captaincy was marked by. That, you know, you set a new kind of template for how things can be done. This is very much classic PCB that we've known during all the bad years, where everyone's fighting with one another and blaming, you know, the players are being blamed, and there's discontent, and there's, you know, old faces being brought back. All of that stuff has been really the worrying part, more so than the results.
I agree with that. And one more point about this is now the funny thing is with Pakistan cricket, there's another couple of players who are odds on to be brought back, and they're Shoaib Malik and Mohammad Hafeez. So I don't know what people make of that, but then bringing two 38-year-olds back into your team doesn't quite suggest that you have a strong enough domestic structure. What was striking for me was how negative Misbah was about Pakistan's own prospects, even in the future, because someone mentioned, I think one of the journalists asked a question about Shadab struggling, and he said, name one spinner, leg spinner, on the domestic circuit that we aren't giving a chance to. And he had a point in that there aren't too many leg spinners doing well in domestic cricket. Someone jokingly brought up Usman Kadir's name, the son of the late Abdul Kadir, who's now going to Australia to ply his trade. So Misbah was very negative about not only Pakistan's current team, but the talent coming through.
I was a bit surprised by that, but actually, because if I'm, again, like, I don't follow it that closely, but I saw Zafar Gaur's name in the CPL a bunch of times. And more importantly, when we talk about bench strength, I think it's important to mention also that this is a team that was winning consistently for the past 3 years. It's been ranked number one. It's sorted out a lot of it. It's like, it's 20 overs, so you don't necessarily need, like, if you've got somebody like Babar, who's been in great form throughout, you don't need, like, a, you know, test quality batsman in the side. And more importantly, I think somebody mentioned this on Twitter or somewhere, that Pakistan's record when Babar scored under 20 runs was 100% wins. So there's a problem that's being called out for, like, yes, sure, Pakistan's batting when it comes to tests, and especially in ODIs where they, you know, you need a little bit more staying power. We've had a lot of issues. It's really not been an issue with the T20 side. So I think I don't think this is just being harsh. These are incorrect statements.
I've got a few more questions for you guys. Firstly, some respect for Shoaib Malik from both of you, because he's on 11 match winning streak in the CPL and he might just lift the trophy this weekend. So firstly, he might not be such a bad addition at all, Daniel. So secondly, the other question that had me is, obviously this is just a bilateral series, they've lost, there's no need to overreact because they've had such great record over the last 3-4 years. One thing that I kind of came to my mind was, how can you lose a game repeatedly by getting your batting order so wrong? Because Sarfraz Ahmed, at least in recent times, the last couple of years, Daniel, I think you also written about it, he's kind of struggled to get the big hits away, which is a big deal, which is an important thing in T20 cricket. In a big chase, like you said, there's a big chase, a medium chase, and a really small total that they had to chase. They were outplayed, and repeatedly, the one common feature was them getting their batting order wrong, with Sarfraz coming ahead of a guy like Imad Wasim when the target, the asking date was over 9, over 10 sometimes even. Those are problems that are solvable, as opposed to something like bench strength or, you know, domestic circuit, etc., which are bigger issues. The batting order seems like a much more solvable problem to the neutral viewer, Daniel.
Yeah, I mean, I take your point. Having said that, yes, there was criticism of Sarfraz batting at 4, but then the problem with Sarfraz's lack of form is, where does he bat? If he can't bat in the top 3, because the top 3 is somewhat set. If he bats lower than 4, then the asking rate is too high and he can't get the big hits. So where we saw, he batted at 4 and then he was the one left in the last 3 or 4 overs, and there was absolutely no confidence he'd be able to meet the asking rate. So if you play Sarfraz and you don't play him at 4, you have the other problem. Where does he bat then?
Amir, is it safe to assume that with Misbah in the saddle, Sarfraz's position, etc., safe? And I mean, there's obviously Rizwan that you mentioned, but there's no sort of immediate crisis over his presence in the team or captaincy. That might just be over speculating or too much extrapolation, isn't it?
No, my friend. As far as I can tell you, from what's been, you know, what the birds are saying, there is a lot of insecurity amongst the circles of the Pakistan captain about what his long-term future is. Whether the question of should he or shouldn't he be replaced, I think before that even comes into play, you've got the fact that there is the smell of intrigue in the air. And whether that's, as you said, like I said, that's probably at this point just extrapolation. I think the biggest thing that's been holding it back for a very long time has been the fact that there's no obvious successor. And I think obviously, this was covered in a recent Cricket Info article as well. And it is all for all those points. I think, again, something that was really irritating was that in a T20, you really don't need to bat all your batters anyways. Like, if you get your batting order right, you've got 20 overs, you don't have to bat out all 10 wickets. You can, there has to be flexibility inherent to any T20 batting approach. And I think, again, that was the problem with Pakistan, that you've seen, there was just like, certain plans that they just tried to make some sense of, and when they weren't working, there wasn't really, you know, something original to try and like start something new. They seemed to just like make those problems worse as the innings went on.
What's kind of ironic, which has been spoken about widely, is that we've done a couple of episodes in the past, one with Hassan and earlier, this is in the last 3 years, 2016 World T20, which was a kind of low, after which Mickey Arthur took charge. Since then, I think they won 11 series on the trot. There was no World T20, probably for the first time in a 3-year cycle, there was no World T20. Will it be peak Pakistan if they just casually bounce back at next year's World Cup? Because we're so close to the World T20 now. And suddenly, there seems to be so many more problems that are coming to the surface. The other question, of course, is having played so long in the Gulf, in the Emirates, nearly a decade now, are they finding Pakistani conditions alien? I mean, out of sheer habit of having played elsewhere?
Yeah, I think it might be when you formed winning habits. In particular, in a set of conditions, it's difficult to transition even if you're going back home. I think there's definitely an element of that. For example, in The UAE, I think for a set period of time, there's a statistic that Pakistan scored, I think, 150. They won every single game for a certain period of time. T20, I'm talking about. But yeah, Misbah said and Safra said Babur struggled to adjust to the slowness of the wickets, and just the sheer familiarity of the UAE might have played a part. But to your second question, I'm a lot more pessimistic about Pakistan's chances now in the World T20. Yes, Pakistan are unpredictable and we can go down that road. But Pakistan now have a number of players first team players who are out of form. Fakhar Zaman, remember that 91 he scored in Harare to beat Australia in the tri-series final? I think that was the most impressive T20 Pakistan played in their entire 3-year spell. Fakhar hasn't crossed 25 since that point. Teams seem to have figured him out. They don't give him any width. They bowl at his hips, essentially. Babur, this was by far his worst T20I series in his career, even though we've seen the statistics about how Pakistan don't generally lose even if Babur's out of form. But yeah, long term that can't be sustainable. We have the Sarfraz question, and the bowling seems to have fallen off a cliff as well. Over the last 2 years, Hassan Ali is now out of the side, Shadab is struggling, Shinbari isn't evolving, Wahab Riaz is inconsistent as ever, Amir, who knows what we'll get from Amir, although he was decent to see their best bowler, I think. But yeah, I'm a little more pessimistic, and yeah, this is why.
I think, firstly, I wouldn't... So there's a very small sample size of Pakistan playing back in Pakistan after the UAE exile, which starts in 2015 with the Zimbabwe side, and then there's the World 11, and now this series. And so prior
West
to this...
West Indies as well, I think.
The West Indies, yes, exactly. Yeah, I remember missing one. So I think they've been doing pretty well in terms of like the batting. And certainly with like quite a few players, like the series that I've watched in person, which is 2015 and 16, they seem to be more liberated than they've ever been in the UAE. And from that, I would also follow that we shouldn't read too much into this one series. There was too much happening off the field, including the fact that Sri Lanka didn't send, still for a lot of sides, getting the second stringers would make things simpler. With a team like Pakistan, where I think their sort of mental concentration and kind of being switched on is so variable, I think that probably went against them. And you know, just seeing a bunch of like people that haven't really played before or seen before, and in an atmosphere which where there was really an unnecessary level of confusion and toxicity, I think this is not that worrying, I would say. I think what Daniel pointed out, like some of the long-term issues, Sarfraz and Fakhar, you know, that might be something you'd want to sort out. There's a lot of concern about Shadab as well, and Hassan, etc. But I don't think we're at panic stations yet. Again, I think when it comes to a world tournament, if Pakistan is for any reason favored heavily, then they don't do well. So at the very least, you know, if they realize that as well, and they're just trying to get into the underdog role again, so that they have the narrative to turn around when that happens. And in fact, you mentioned Shoaib Malik. I think he's the prime example of why Pakistan is like this. Like I often say, like Pakistan, a Pakistani with something to prove is one of the world's, you know, most unstoppable forces. and Shoaib Malik's had been wanting to prove a lot of things for a while. He was again out of the T20 side, etc. And you know, I really feel no one's made enough mention of the fact that he's played the entire CPL wearing a black bandana, very, very like very LL Cool J styles approach to the bandana as well. And are we seeing this new gangster Shoaib Malik? What's happening? I think also keeping in mind that in his time as captain of Sialkot, he was a really super successful captain. So maybe he's rediscovered that mojo as well. But I'm going to say it's because of the bandana.
I'm just going to jump in there. First of all, yeah, Shoaib Malik, I think I might have been a little harsh initially when I said they might be recalling Shoaib Malik and Hafiz. But the larger point was about whether they had depth in terms of younger players. Shoaib Malik, if he's good enough, absolutely should play. But the other point that Emma made, he's right that Pakistan, when they're underdogs, are very unpredictable. But there is one notable exception to that. The 2016 World T20, the previous World T20, Pakistan were exactly as unfancied because they played ancient cricket. They didn't have the power hitters. They didn't have intelligent captaincy. They had Shahid Afridi's captain, Waqar Yunus, launched an excoriating attack on him when he resigned. So, and Pakistan were completely unfancied, and that is exactly what happened. They won the first game against Bangladesh, and then they were heavily outplayed by Australia, New Zealand, and one of the team I don't quite remember. But yeah, so, Emma, do you worry that Pakistan might actually have a repeat of the 2016 World Cup in terms of how they go about it, given if they slip down this road again?
At one level, you're always worried for Pakistan.
Good luck. Again. Good luck predicting.
Yeah. You know, I think that's the existential state we must always exist in. Like, for example, a great example of this is actually this ODI World Cup that just passed. I think in like every sense of the way, like, you know, I tried to mentally and emotionally prepare myself for Pakistan not doing well or, you know, whatever, things catching up to them. We were in terrible form going into that World Cup. And somehow, like, you know, that loss to West Indies was even more disastrous than I could have imagined. And you know, and at the end of that World Cup, they kind of gave us a good story. It just reminded me that no matter how much you try, you can't really come to this sort of zen where you can then analyze Pakistan cricket objectively. I think the biggest difference between 2016 and 2020 is that 2016 had a lot of these guys, in the squad and the larger setup. And then also the absence, it had just been one season or two season of the PSL at that point. It was really the end of that previous pure exile era. You know, like, I think in the last maybe 4 or 5 years where, cricket slowly started coming back to Pakistan, the PSL has really had a huge impact. It's a very different era. So I think in that sense, there's a big difference between these two sides. I think also that no matter what Pakistan does, because there's just a lot of T20 happening, that it would still, people would look at the fact that they've been number one for a long time and kind of play that up. And most importantly, I think, you know, all these different problems, especially in T20 cricket, can be overcome by good strategy and, you know, good kind of cameos from everyone who knows what their roles are. And does that well. And I think Pakistan's T20 side, the reason it was so good was that, you know, up and down, Sarfaraz's role was perhaps always in the batting lineup an issue, but it didn't really become one because everybody else was doing a good job. And outside of that, it was a really well-rounded side. And I think when you have that, you still have that to play with. I would be genuinely surprised. I can say this like 8 months or 6 months, whatever, from the event itself, that I would be surprised if they don't do well. But again, you know, Pakistan could be overtaken by aliens in the next 3 months and, you know, they destroy Pakistan cricket. So I don't want to predict anything.
Yeah, well done. Very measured answer, Amir, covering all bases. Just a couple of things. Firstly, not to forget that Pakistan actually won the ODI series comfortably. Daniel, it would be remiss of us to miss the main storyline of the series, which is Sri Lanka winning it 3-0. It had all the elements of a Sri Lankan victory, let's put it that way. A left-hander opener firing up top, a mystery spinner doing the business, even a fast bowler picking up wickets early on and controlling things in the T20. How has it been to watch them, and how surprised have the Pakistan public been to see a side like this win? You did make the point that they were quite dismissive of the fact that a weekend side has made it to Pakistani shores for the series.
Yeah, I mean, the surprise can't be overstated because, Pakistan was just dismayed. 10 players weren't coming. This was second string side, whatever. I was in Karachi to cover the ODI series as well. And that's, to some extent, that was the sort of series Pakistan expected. And that was the order that Pakistan expected would prevail, even in Lahore. But the thing that impressed me most about Sri Lanka is, yes, they're perpetually in crisis, allegedly. They have some of their big hitters out of form. The interesting thing for me was, because people like the big names like Angelo Matthews, Dinesh Chandimal, maybe even to some extent Malinga, even though he's in good form now, they didn't come. This allowed a Sri Lankan board that's maybe historically been, I don't want to say scared, but apprehensive about dropping these big names. The fact that they were out of the side and some young hungry players had the chance to play, that might have played up in their favour, because Angelo Matthews has been struggling for form for a while. I think ditto for Chandimal. And so these players, some of them, they played with freedom that that was evident. They were there to prove a point. Some of these young, I mean, the man of the match in the second and the third T20 guys were players who'd never played a T20 international before. And Gunnar Tilaka, who scored 133 in the third game, and then he was man of the match in the first game, first T20. I hadn't, to be fair, seen much of him before the series, but I was struck by how elegant he was and how obviously talented he was. And I actually met him, I interviewed him between the second and the third games, and he spoke about how he thought that this series had been a way for a lot of these players to come back in and maybe edge out some of the senior players potentially. So, there's lots of good stories coming from Sri Lanka. I mean, when you have a guy who scores 78 on debut, and then another guy, Oshada Fernando, I don't think too many people had heard of him before outside of Sri Lanka. So, I think Sri Lanka, Ratnaike, the Sri Lanka coach, was beaming at the press conference at the end. Incredibly gracious, nice man. I think if you're a Sri Lankan fan, you can take a lot of heart. Sri Lanka have been quite unpredictable recently. They beat South Africa in South Africa. They beat Pakistan in the UAE. So, maybe Sri Lanka is the new Pakistan.
Amir, is it time for you to accept that, at least in the context of 2019, Sri Lanka have kind of outdone Pakistan on the unpredictability stakes? They've pulled off miracle after miracle throughout the year.
I think I would do a great disservice if I... If we don't recognize that Sri Lanka is, I mean, just been one of the most amazing sides in world cricket for so long, and totally capable of this kind of stuff. And I think I've always felt there's a kindred spirit between Pakistan, West Indies and Sri Lanka's cricket sides, in their unconventional approaches, their dysfunctional institutions. There's a lot of stuff that it comes from post-colonial societies, etc. But these three in particular have had similar sorts of narratives across cricket's history. And Sri Lanka itself, I mean, it's just been always had such a it has wonderful cricketers. It has really this intoxicating cricket culture to it. I'm sure a lot of people have read that novel Chinaman, and it does this fantastic job of really bringing Sri Lankan cricket live to you. But even with you guys on Cricket Info, I think Andrew Fernando is such a magical writer and does such great justice to Sri Lankan cricket. So I think the kind of year that they've had, like this isn't surprising. Like this is kind of the Sri Lanka's character in this reality show. Or this film or whatever, it is part of that character.
We'll play that bit about Fernando on the other podcast, the Stump Mike Dusra, which comes out every second week. Fidel will be thrilled, no doubt. Just sticking on the ODI series point and coming to the other side of the story, which is that Karachi hosted its first ODIs in 10 years, which is quite a long time, and you wouldn't wish that on any country to go, a cricket-crazy country especially, to go without international cricket for so long. Daniel, just watching on TV, especially the first game, I think it was after a rain washed out of Sunday, if I'm not wrong. Watching on TV, it felt like the crowds were sparse. Did it have to do with the rain, or did the interest pick up through the series? How did Karachi receive its first sort of international one-day game in over a decade?
I think, it was a number of these factors. So first of all, a couple of weeks before the series, there was rumours the series might be scrapped altogether. And I'm sure that hindered the PCB's planning and their marketing and the way they sold their tickets and how many were sold. And then there were a lot of stories about how extreme the security would be. And I think that at some point it has to turn fans off, because I actually went to the games in a PCB shuttle, which makes it a lot easier. But, I mean, fans have to either arrive insanely early or be put through an absolute rigmarole in terms of how many security checks they have to go through and how random sometimes the policing is. Someone will tell you, oh, that's not allowed. Somebody else might say another thing. So I think that also plays a part. But then there was the weather. There was the fact that the series was confirmed late. And I think... I also heard that the PCB weren't assisted by the provincial by the provincial government in marketing the series. The provincial government didn't pick up the budget for marketing the series as much as it did with the West Indies series. So I think it's a number of these factors. The fact that the game on Sunday had to be postponed to a Monday didn't help either. So I think it's a lot of those things combined put together that created the perfect storm for Karachi, because Karachi's famously a cricket match, arguably the most cricket match city in the entire country. So it was a shame. The cricket wasn't the most captivating either, I'd say, in terms of the results. So, yeah, it was a shame, but I don't think it's a pattern.
I think Daniel's done a very good job of covering the larger issues. I think one really disturbing parallel for me, and I was so happy that the worst impact of it was an empty stadium, was that in 2009, when the Sri Lankan team was attacked in Lahore, at that point, the province of Punjab, where Lahore is capital, there was actually a sort of constitutional battle happening where the federal government had dismissed the provincial government and imposed governor's rule, which, just like it sounds, is a colonial era kind of law. And so there was the bureaucracy of the province was really kind of caught, because in especially that province, again, the provincial government had been in power for a very long time and was used to controlling everything. And, you know, the fact that the kind of state functions that were meant to prevent that incident from happening were caught up in this battle surely played a part. And coming into this series, like, right, there was rumors that had been cancelled. Then it's announced that it's back on. There's 10 days to go. And at that point, there was, for various reasons, the city of Karachi, basically, there was a three-way fight between the city government, the provincial government, and the federal government. And particularly the PCB at this point is very closely associated with the federal government, which is run by Imran Khan's government. And so there was already this battle happening right when the series was happening. And I was quite worried about what the impact of that would be. And the most obvious one was that, you know, most of the factors that Daniel mentioned existed in some form for the PSL and the West Indies games that happened in the city, and people still showed up for it. At this point in this series, until the last ODI, like all the kind of marketing stuff around the city was stuff that was left over from the PSL. There wasn't actually anything around that was letting you know that there was a cricket match happening, which otherwise is really over the top. Like literally you can be miles away from the stadium and there's cricket-related paraphernalia all over the city, and you're very much aware that Karachi's hosting a match. And in fact, again, when you look at it from just this purely, you know, political institutional angle, previously the provincial governments had been really keen to own the narrative of having cricket back in the city and being able to provide security and, you know, have whatever, all the arrangements done fine, et cetera, et cetera. And at this point, when it was happening, there wasn't really a lot of ownership at that basic local level. And I think that was always going to be a huge issue, and it could have manifested in many ways. What had happened 10 years ago, that would have been obviously the nuclear kind of outcome. And God, whatever that was, that didn't happen. And I think, that was probably the biggest differentiator between this series and the previous ones.
Yeah, so Emmer sums that up perfectly. He adds to the points that I didn't make as well, and I think he knows Karachi much better than I do. It's my first visit in 11 years. One more thing that I think is worth discussing in terms of a differentiator between the PSL and this is, of course, that these were ODI games, and then I guess we must talk about whether it's harder to market ODI games. I think that might be a factor generally, the fact that it was hot weather, the fans have to arrive well before the start time on most occasions. From the people I've spoken to, they don't seem to think that in itself is a problem. But then in Pakistan, it shouldn't be a problem given that Pakistanis, beggars can't be choosers. We can't choose to not turn up for ODI games because Karachi, who knows when you might see cricket again in Pakistan. But having said that, I felt personally that the crowd, whatever crowd did turn up, weren't particularly captivated by the contest itself. Maybe that's the nature of relatively uncompetitive games in general, but then I personally do worry about the ODI game long-term in Pakistan, especially if we begin to have regular ODIs. I can easily envisage empty stadiums or emptier stadiums than was normal maybe a decade ago, 15 years ago in Pakistan.
Was it much better when the PSL came to Karachi? Was it so much better because it was T20 between city-based franchises?
I think, as somebody who's living in the city, it was a really completely different situation. And part of it was, again, outside of the control of cricket. Like, there'd been crazy torrential rains happening. The roads were flooded. There was one of the main, the major alternative route to when you go to the stadium that had been dug up for months beforehand. So there's a lot of chaos and throughout all of this, the local authorities were fighting. So it was very different in terms of just being in Karachi. You know, shops had been shut for like a very long time. But I think to a larger point, the problem that Pakistan had with cricket being away, and now when it comes back, this like the need for like security and all that kind of stuff, is that it couldn't do what India managed to do very successfully, which is just take the national team's games that might not attract crowds in the major cities to the smaller kind of metros. So you could put like, you know, most kinds of matches in Multan, Faisalabad and Peshawar and attract full houses very easily. So I think if inshallah that becomes an option, for some time at least this problem can be mitigated. And I think if the ODI game is in trouble, might probably be a larger question for the game itself. I think in a country as large as Pakistan, all you have to do is just take the game away. If you can, you know, with security, etc., not being an issue, then they can just take the game to like smaller and smaller kind of locations. And these are huge populations that have never kind of hosted a lot of international cricket or any international cricket. You'll be able to get full houses quite easily.
Yeah, that's a good point. The only logistical, I think, barrier to doing that partially is when the international security experts come and they have a look at how security arrangements have been done. I think somehow they haven't. There's a sense that they might not feel as secure with the way security is conducted in those smaller cities. And then the problem of accommodation. I think Multan is now getting a 5-star hotel. But a lot of the smaller cities don't have the sort of accommodation that international cricketers now come to expect. So I think that's improving too. But I think these, other than if these two points can be reckoned with, Emma's spot on. I'm sure those smaller stadiums will be absolutely rocking full houses.
I think, just from a organizational perspective, I'm thinking about it like, you know, right, like, for example, Multan or Faisalabad, etc., you might not have the same kind of accommodations. But you could go back to an earlier era of cricket where, like, you know, the local elites would host visiting teams in their mansions or whatever. And like, the transition needs to happen. It's conceivable. I think the biggest roadblock is always going to be security. And so, and I think whatever the future happens will necessarily take place within that. And, you know, I think that is again just like, another really unfortunate impact of how the security situation has been on cricket is the smaller towns continue to miss out. And so hopefully we'll be able to rectify that in some form or another.
The thing that's worked in India is that they've not really overdone it in the sense that the bigger centers still get a number of marquee games. For example, in the next week, I think there's a test match in Ranchi, which is not really one of the premier venues, but big team like South Africa is touring India. And they've kind of taken these calls because they've seen successes with one or two cities or towns in the past, which I think is a model that's, I'm guessing, worked in Pakistan in the past with smaller centers getting big games, test matches or one days, whatever it is. Security, talking of security, just a couple of quick ones to wrap up the pod. One is, do you guys see or sense something changing this time, something different about this time compared to all the previous times cricket has come to Pakistan in the last decade? I'm talking purely from number of dignitaries from outside boards from outside Asia visiting Pakistan. I've seen Cricket Australia chief. There's Tom Harrison from the ECB who seems to have come for the game yesterday. There's also reports that Ireland cricket's representatives have been visiting. Do you sense a shift this time, Daniel, compared to what's happened? Emir, you can also weigh in on this. Do you generally sense that this time could be different in terms of bringing more and more teams to Pakistan?
I mean, it possibly could. The only thing I'd say with I think the Australian board representative was due to visit last week, but then didn't because of a meeting that they had in Dubai. So they're going to visit at some point, I think, in the next few days. But then the Australian tour is, I believe, in 2022, same with the England tour. So, I mean, it's impossible to make predictions about Pakistan in 3 years, what the security situation might be, what the political situation might be, whether even this current PCB administration will be around by then. So I don't think it's worth speculating on what will happen in 2022, whether those teams will come. But yeah, I do think that the way Sri Lanka, these tours are beginning to go off now relatively seamlessly. The inconvenience is passed on to the fans, but it doesn't seem to bother the players who visit. They feel safe, they feel secure. So in that sense, if Ireland visit at some point, I think that will be a big step. Having said that, I spoke about how I interviewed Kunathilaka, and one of the things that he said was that it's okay at times to have ODIs and T20s where you can have a game and then come back to your hotel, not go out. But then when you play test matches in that sort of mindset where you play for the whole day, then you just stay in your room, you have dinner, you go again, same routine for five consecutive days, players begin to find that quite tiresome at some point. So there is that psychological challenge of getting players to accept playing test cricket in these conditions. But in terms of security, I think now the justifications for not visiting in terms of a personal threat to your own physical safety, I think that's diminishing now.
You know, obviously this is a matter that just doesn't involve the cricket boards, but the states negotiating themselves. And in that sense, the Pakistani state and the security establishment has been very keen on using the return of international cricketers to Pakistani soil in whatever shape or form. And by the way, not just cricketers. So we've had a lot of foreign video bloggers coming to Pakistan and wrestlers and people who like do stunts and I don't know what, but like generally people who are like visibly from abroad have been coming to Pakistan.
Ahmed hasn't been a fan of many of those.
which basically is Dania's way of saying that he is a fan of all of them. So
you know,
let that be the hill that he dies on. But so that is something that the state has been very invested in for a while, and now you've got the government headed by a very famous, possibly Pakistan's greatest ever cricketer. And so whatever else, you know, your opinion on Imran Khan, who is a very polarizing person as a politician, maybe this is probably his strongest suit, right? Because this is a situation where he's asking you to believe in Pakistan the way he believes in Pakistan, and it's about cricket, so he can obviously bring up his own past, and in this sense it'll be relevant, and it's something that everybody... generally, there's this public support for it. There's the support of the political and security establishment. So in that sense, I feel that, you know, this is obviously something that Pakistan will be looking to push for. There's so many factors that kind of impact this, again, outside of cricket boards. You know, like, for example, when it just comes to someone like India, it's never going to be the BCCI's call. You know, and similarly with like a lot of other countries, it could be that maybe the boards are not that interested, but you know, the governments, there's been some diplomatic kind of agreement or something, and so they managed to pull some favors and send over some teams. And again, like, it's not just cricket teams. Like, Pakistan has been trying to get all sorts of different sporting and cultural people coming to the country to showcase that the country is much better, safer since then. And I think because cricket is the biggest ticket in town, obviously whatever success that you manage to pull off here will have the biggest impact in terms of perception, both locally and for the people who are trying to do this, more importantly, abroad.
Yep. If Sri Lanka's players and coaches have come and they've gone back saying that more and more countries, every other country will visit soon, those are promising signs for Pakistan. As for the cricket team, they now travel to Australia, I think, for a full tour, which could be Misbah's first big test outside home conditions. There's lots and lots to look forward to in the coming months as we build up to the World T20. Thanks for joining us on another episode of Stump Mike Podcast. Thanks, Daniel and Emir, for your time.
Pleasure.
Thanks a lot, man.
Cheers, Emir. And thanks to you, listener, as always, for your company. Remember to leave us a rating and your feedback on iTunes. It has helped more and more people find the podcast. Do all the good things you do wherever else you get your podcast from. Until next time then, from all of us at ESPN Cricket Forum, it's goodbye. Take care.